Welcome to Lecture 12. I believe it's Lecture 12 this week. Has anybody got any questions, queries, stuff they would like to ask about before I get started on the data link layer? I'm just going to dash in and turn on AutoVox. We got our new computers. So there are 5 new computers sitting under the bench that I need to set up today or tomorrow. And they're significantly faster than these things. So that will be fun for us.
Yeah, congratulations on the new computers, Kerry. And I've downloaded the Cisco-pedia, and looking through it, it's fairly voluminous. I wonder if you had specific sections in mind that might be more beneficial for us to read before we do the prac with you in a couple of weeks' time.
Well, I wouldn't recommend you necessarily read bits of the Cisco-pedia before the practical. I think what I'd recommend is that you use it to pull up information about various commands as you work. And I will generally provide the commands that you're pulling up information on. You may want to possibly acquaint yourself with the various modes, although I will talk about those in lecture before we get into the practical exercise. So privileged exec, your user exec, interface configuration, those sorts of things. And probably configure yourself with configuring an Ethernet interface and configuring a serial interface would probably be the sections I would target. It's sort of one of those things that you refer to as you go along. It's a reference that will be a little bit better than the online help in case you want more information on a command as you work through.
I've read through the Chapter 11. In fact, that's what I was doing this afternoon, and there's quite a lot of stuff about the various levels, commands like enable and disable and configure and so on. Not really a whole bunch of commands there, but enough to get started. And I was going to have a play early next week on the bundle and see if I could try a few of those commands just for fun. You could give me an idea of how you plan to use the Cisco-pedia. That's useful, Kerry.
Basically, what you're going to do is you're going to build a network topology, or the class is going to build a network topology. And everybody gets a go. Even if you're not in the class, you get to jump on the bundle and play with it if you want to. So there will be 4 of you possibly playing, maybe 5. We are going to set up a topology that involves connecting 3 routers together by serial interfaces. Each of the serial interfaces will be given IP addresses. There will be a subnet on each of the LAN interfaces. And in fact, I can even share the Dropbox link of the exercise if that would make people happy. They would get some idea as to what they're going to do before we actually sit down and do it.
Yeah, sounds good. That link will be useful. Just have a quick look through and maybe know what needs to be prepared for, what threats are in store.
Alrighty, here it comes. And the TTS won't speak it because it's a link. There we go. Let's just make sure that turned up. Now you typed your name into chat, Sabahattin. Did I actually get to what you were going to say, or is this another thing you wanted to say?
I haven't asked yet. I wanted to know. Oh, okay. Hello. I wanted to know if we could discuss exam questions, because I had to reset one of the exams. No, it must be said to do much more than get slightly higher points, but still, this is an interesting question.
If you can remember what the exam question was, I'm happy to discuss it. Otherwise, we can sort out a time in my afternoon, your morning, to Skype about it. But if you happen to remember the question in question, so to speak, I can certainly talk about it.
Yeah, it was about broadcast domains. They gave a topology with switches and routers and workstations, and there were 3 switches.
I wonder if it just disappeared. Okay, am I still here for everyone else?
Yep, you're here.
Okay. Ventrilo has one of these sort of dropout things where people disappear and then you're not sure whether they're there or not. And then you come back and then the people are there and it's all good. I have to wait for Sabaton to come back to finish that one. I know exactly which question he's talking about. And it's the one where it's got three switches and a router and a couple of hubs, and basically the broadcast domain is separated by the switches and the routers, but it's not separated by the hubs, so you've got to sit down and work out which things are actually separating the broadcast domains and which things are not separating the broadcast domains. And switches separate net broadcast domains, routers separate broadcast domains, and hubs do not. So that's that question. But I'll see if he's back yet. Alright, let's start on the lecture content I've got here, and then when he comes back or sorts his audio, we can sort something out. It's his internet server. Going up and down like a blind person's mood at a web accessibility conference. Okie dokie. Now, shouldn't be like that. I should be less cynical in my old age. Now, last week we started to talk about the data link layer, and as we recall, the data link layer is layer 2 of the OSI reference model. It is the layer that is responsible for dealing with media contention and getting frames on and off the actual media. Okay, so it's below the network layer. We're dealing with nodes. I remember talking about that last week before I got into my little talk about wireless networks and stuff, and it deals with usually things like the MAC address and that sort of stuff at layer 2. So, alright, has anybody got a command prompt handy? Can everybody who's on lecture please open themselves a Windows command prompt? This is one of those infuriating we need to participate things. So if we can all do that, Windows R, CMD, or however you want to get your command prompt open.
Open.
Alrighty. And if you can, if you all can run an ARP space minus A, and I will just type that into the chat, just in case anybody is like me and can't spell that thing. And I want you to have a look at what shows up in the table. Okay, I'm going to give you an example of what I've got in my table. I've got 192.168.100.4, and I've got 08:00:20:3A:D5:... Can't see the end of that. C14E, even. Now, what the ARP table does is it's called Address Resolution Protocol. And basically what the ARP table is responsible for is to keep a map between IP addresses and hardware MAC addresses on an Ethernet segment. Can anybody tell me why it would be important to keep a mapping between IP addresses and hardware? Oh, and this runs on the MAC terminal as well, Steve, just in case you thought we were going to Windows only you. ARP-A should work in the terminal. At least it did for our other Mac users last semester. Does anybody know why we'd want to have a mapping between IP addresses and hardware addresses on a local area network? Can anyone think of why this might be important? Important, even.
Steve.
Yes, Steve.
Because if you are doing something with a network that can be routed internally within the machine, then it doesn't need to route outside onto the network, like between a VM and a host. I mean, host operating system.
Not really. Sort of, kind of. Probably give you about 3 out of 10 for that one, but that's okay. Anybody else got any ideas why we'd want a mapping between hardware MAC addresses and IP addresses? This isn't actually a trick question, but I do understand that you guys might not be sure what I'm after. So, anybody else want to have a go?
Yeah, I think it's probably to do with having a cache of the devices on the network so that it doesn't need to make an address resolution query every time it needs to find the the IP address and the machine address for any individual device on the network to construct the header.
I would give you, I'd give you 8 out of 10 for that one. Excellent. So, okay, what you've got to understand, guys, is that when you are working at layer 3 of the OSI reference model, you tend to deal with IP addresses. So you deal with 192.168.100.4 and 192.168.100.10. But when you actually work on an Ethernet segment, you are dealing with the MAC addresses or the hardware addresses of the card. To talk to a particular node on a local segment, you need to use the hardware address of that node, because that is how Ethernet communicates. It doesn't communicate with IP addresses, it communicates with the hardware addresses of the MAC addresses of the network cards. Did anyone notice in the output of their ARP-A command, they should have seen the IP address and the hardware address of their default gateway? That's if you know what your default gateway is.
I can certainly find it, but it went past too fast for me to be able to pull it out because other people were talking at the same time. But I know what the IP address of the default gateway and the MAC address, although I don't remember off the top of my head the MAC address. Oh.
Well, that's all right. You are aware that you can go ARP space dash A and then put vertical bar more, and that will give it to you a page at a time. That might stop those pesky people talking problem. I'd give you a bit more chance to have a look at it.
Yeah, I've got quite a few statics on this anyway, but that would make a lot of sense to do that in future.
The other thing you can also do, and this works under most operating systems, is you can go ARP space minus A space greater than myARP.txt, and then you can have happy fun times in Notepad. Now, I'm not saying you have to do that right now. I'm just saying that when you're running commands such as ipconfig, and if you're running commands like route, or you're running commands like ARP that are console-based commands under an operating system, redirect the output to a file so that you can read them at your leisure.
Yeah, there's plenty of piping in the labs, Kerry, so yeah, we get plenty of practice at doing that.
I was pretty sure I'd put it in. I don't want to start World War VII, but did they cover that in Discovery at all? Alright, I'll have to ask later. Output redirection, it is good for you. Use it. It's amazing. And it will allow you to look at various things in a timely manner and make your life, well, somewhat easier. I don't know, I get sick of pulling things off the screen with the Jaws cursor all the time. And if there are better ways, I'll tend to use them. Alrighty, let's continue onwards and upwards. So, it's worth mentioning, as I spoke about switches last week, and I spoke about the content address memory table, and I spoke about the... I'm just going to make sure I'm recording, because that could be bad. And I am, so the world is a happy place. Now, as I spoke about the other day, there are various devices that keep ARP tables, and they keep port tables, and they keep various tables of things. So switches will tend to keep a MAC address table that maps things to ports. Can anybody tell me what sort of network device, apart from a workstation, would be likely to keep an ARP table? Anybody got any ideas? Yes, Charlene. Yes! 10 points. A router needs to keep an ARP table. In fact, has anybody ever been into their router, if you can get into your router, and actually looked at its ARP table? Some routers will show you, some routers won't. There are some that will show you a wireless association table, and some that will show you an ARP table. Yes, Steve?
My router shows, like, the DHCP table. Is that... I know it's not technically the same thing, but it's got the same information, right? Because it shows the MAC addresses and which IP addresses they've been issued.
It's the same in the fact that it'll show you IP addresses to MAC address mappings for DHCP, but if you statically assign something on your network segment, it won't show up in the DHCP table. However, it will show up in the ARP table if you access it. Does that make sense?
Yep, perfect.
There's another app for the iDevice called, think it's LandScan. Oh, let's have a look here. It's awesome. And it will scan your computer and tell you what devices you've got there. And that can be very handy if you're trying to find the IP address of some silly bridged virtual machine that's disappeared onto the network somewhere, because it'll actually probe for it. Okay, one of the apps I've got is called iNet. They're fairly expensive apps, I will say that. They're about $5 or $6. Completely worth it, if you ask me. Because there are times when I'm on a network and I'm wirelessly attached and I need to do a scan of what MAC addresses and IP addresses are on the network. And, well, I happen to have my iPhone on me. So there is a better one, I think, called LandScan, but I've got to get in touch with my friend and ask him which one is the better one. And I will get back to everybody with which is the better application for scanning things, sorry, excuse me, on the iDevice. And they also work on iPod touches and stuff as well. Now, last week I talked about the physical network being how the actual cables are run, and the logical network is how devices are organized based on the hierarchical address structure. In other words, the ones that the administrators and stuff are responsible for setting. Now, the data link layer allows the upper layers to put data onto the network segment without concerning themselves with the underlying topology of the network. So it allows, say, TCP/IP and IPX and AppleTalk to be able to put information onto the network segment without actually worrying about whether it's Ethernet, wireless, fiber, etc., even token ring and FDDI. Any questions on that? Okay, the media access control basically is responsible for handling the contention of the media. It controls how frames get on and off the media. So generally, a device has a card or interface that handles talking to the media. So you've either got a network card, a wireless network card, a Bluetooth dongle, those sorts of things. Frames are formatted and created, and they're different for each media. So if you look at token ring frames, they're different to wireless frames, which are different to Ethernet frames. So that's certainly something that's worth keeping in mind. By default, wireless frames can actually be bigger. They can actually be 2,346 bytes, which is bigger than the regular Ethernet MTU of 1,500 bytes. Anybody want to interject anything or ask anything before I continue on? Alrighty, a frame has header, data, and trailer. So these are the sort of things that a frame can contain. It doesn't necessarily have to contain these things. Start and stop indicator fields, they tell you where the frame starts and stops, obviously. Naming or addressing fields, so how do we refer to the workstations? Do we refer to them as a MAC address, or do we refer to them as some sort of name or whatever, like in NetBIOS and those sorts of things. The type field, which is the type of protocol data unit, that tells you whether you're using 802.3 or Ethernet 2 framing, and IP uses Ethernet 2 framing, and other things use 802.3, but that's so you can differentiate which actual protocol is being carried in the frames. Control codes, such for flow control and things like that. The data field, which is obviously the frame payload, which actually is the stuff that you're interested in getting from workstation to workstation. Okay, any questions on any of that before I continue?
Yeah, the flow control field, Kerry, does that have any role in collision detection or collision avoidance, or is there another quality type field that, like a checksum field or something like that, that would do that?
Generally speaking, if you're dealing with collision avoidance and stuff, that's all a bit tricky, because basically what happens with collision avoidance is that you actually sort of have a little chirp of data at the physical layer, and then you see what comes back, and that will tell you whether the transmission medium is free or not. If you're looking at things like token ring and FDDI, which both use rings, token ring, original versions of token ring using one ring, FDDI using two rings, one running in either direction to detect and repair for cable breaks, you end up passing the token, and depending on where the token is and how fast the token is traveling will depend on how much data goes through the network. So you can only transmit if you've got the token. It's a bit like how in some tribal cultures you can't talk unless you're holding the message stick. It's a pretty crude analogy, but that's essentially what the token is. If you don't have the message stick, you're not supposed to be talking. And basically what happens is, I mean, obviously there are two types of media contention methods. So generally speaking, you have what we call deterministic and non-deterministic. Now, deterministic means you can actually figure out how much data is actually going to travel over the medium based on the speed of the network, how much data the token can carry, the latency of passing the token between stations, all of that sort of good stuff. Whereas with a non-deterministic method such as CSMACD, you cannot reliably, predictably estimate how much data will travel over the network at any given time. So that's sort of where the flow control stuff is used in the data link layer.
All right, got it, Kerry. And I assume that most of that becomes less important using switches, since they have a transient point-to-point effect. So presumably ruling out most of the collision incidents that might otherwise happen.
Yeah, if you're completely using... Well, there are two things that get rid of collisions. One of them is full duplex, and the other one is the fact that you're working on a switched topology. You don't tend to get collisions on switches because the way the switches are designed, they are, most of the cheaper ones are store and forward, and the expensive ones are cut through, so you don't have a situation where two packets can collide. So it would be fair to say that on a fully switched topology, you don't see incidences of collisions. That is correct. Okie dokie. Now, the data link layer is split into two sub-layers. One of them is the logical link control. And the logical link control frames the network layer packet and identifies the network layer protocol. Now, the media access control sublayer, and the reason they separate this into the logical link control and the media access control sublayer is so that you can do things like bridge token ring to... bridge token ring to Ethernet and stuff like that, if you've got the right equipment to do so. So the media access control sublayer addresses the frame, marks the beginning and end of the frame, and that's effectively what those things do. Now, the data link layer is not actually documented in any of the RFCs. It's actually documented outside the IETF infrastructure, and it's documented by people like the International Organization for Standards, ISOC, IEEE, American National Standards Institute, ITU, which is I think now called ITUT, and that they are the sort of organisations that deal with this data link and physical layer stuff. Okay, now the media control techniques set how the media is shared, or in fact whether it is shared at all, and the rules for getting frames onto the media. Control and contention, in other words, how do we decide who's talking and what governs how much a particular station is talking? I've already spoken about deterministic and non-deterministic. So you've got things like CSMACD and CSMACA, and they are non-deterministic methods because you can't reliably determine how much data is going to travel over the medium at any given time. Did I talk about bandwidth throughput and good put? I can't remember whether I talked about that this semester.
I don't think you did, Kerry, or at least not recently, if you spoke about it at all.
Okay, well, basically there are three terms. There's bandwidth, which is the theoretical maximum you can get through the link, and there's two sorts of bandwidth. There's analog bandwidth, which is measured in megahertz or gigahertz, and there is digital bandwidth, which is measured in bits per second. You then have the throughput, which is how much data you can actually get through on the network given the theoretical maximum and the framing overhead, and then you have the good put, which is actually what the users see from workstation to workstation. So that's those three terms defined. Now when you're dealing with contention methods such as CSMA CD, it's kind of a bit like our Ventrilo server rules that we have. With CSMACD, you listen to see if somebody is transmitting. If nobody is transmitting, you start to transmit. If you detect that somebody else is transmitting whilst you are transmitting, you stop transmitting and you wait a random amount of time and try retransmitting again. Now, the difference between Ventrilo and our system is you actually keep listening for the actual silence, but with the Ethernet, it actually waits a random amount of time and then it listens again. Now, the way CSMACD works is it detects a collision based on the voltage on the network wires. If the voltage is above a certain point, it assumes that a station is transmitting. And if you're actually working with a hub or whatever, basically if the hub detects a collision, it actually sends a jam signal out to all of the other ports on the hub except for the port that the collision occurred on. And that tells the other stations on the shared media that there has been a collision condition and that they should start their exponential back-off timers. If you fail to retransmit a packet over 15 times, the packet is actually discarded at the data link layer, and it is up to the higher level protocols to deal with the retransmission of that packet. Any questions, queries on any of that? All right. Does anyone want to have a shot at defining full and half duplex?
Half duplex is where senders and receivers alternate in sending and receiving. Full duplex is where they're capable of sending and receiving at the same time, usually over two links rather than one.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. So full duplex can communicate in both directions simultaneously, and half duplex can communicate in one direction at a time, generally with a turnaround delay. So two-way radios are generally speaking half duplex. There probably are full duplex systems somewhere, but I'd say they're fairly rare and would require multiple radios. And then simplex is where a device simply transmits rather than receiving. So if you picture a television station or a radio station, they tend to be simplex. So that's your simplex, your half duplex, and your full duplex. Ah, here comes Sabahattin again, potentially. As I've previously said, if the medium is full duplex, no arbitration is necessary. So we already spoke about that. I spoke about logical versus physical topology, so I'm not going to touch that again necessarily this week unless there are particular questions. There are three common topologies. We've got bus, we've got ring, bus, star, ring, and mesh. There are four of them. A bus topology is a topology where you have two discrete ends to the topology. The signal travels from one end of the bus to the other end of the bus. It's a bit like a bus that leaves the bus depot. It goes brum, brum, brum. It goes to the end of its route. It turns around and it goes brum, 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 and it comes back to the depot. This is a simple bus that does not get hijacked and drive off somewhere else. So for our analogy, that's a bus. A bus is a shared medium. Collisions are important. You need to use an arbitration method such as CSMA CD, CSMA CSMA CA, etc. Looks like everybody's having internet wibblies tonight, which is unfortunate. And usually used with coax. It can also be argued that cable TV and cable internet, if it uses coax, can be considered a bus network if you look at the local CMTS and the stations connected onto the local amount of cable that you happen to be sharing with your neighbours. Okay. Now, a star topology is where we have a device such as a router or... No, where you have a device such as a switch in the middle of the topology and you have machines hanging off the switch. If you look at a hub and you have all the machines connected into a hub, what you actually have is a physical star but a logical bus. If you look at a switch, you actually have a logical star and a physical star. If you have multiple switches connected together, you have a topology that is known as an extended star, where you connect the points of the star to other stars to sort of expand the topology out. Can anyone suggest what would be a potential drawback to having switches connected to switches connected to switches? Is anyone apart from Mike awake? Okay, Steve's awake. Do you have any ideas, Steve?
Well, the only thing I can think of is that the switches don't communicate with one another, each other's ARP tables, and as such, it would be difficult to create a direct path from one device to another over multiple switches.
I'll take your second half of that. Switches do have a media table. They don't necessarily need an ARP table, but probably the point that I want to make is if you're actually going through switches, especially if they're store and forward, you're going to increase the latency of the packets the more switches you travel through. Does that make sense? It's like when you stop at traffic lights and stuff, do you guys have roundabouts in America? Does anybody even know what I'm talking about when I say roundabout? Turning circle? Okay. Well, you know how when you go to... Yeah. You know how when you get to a roundabout, you got to check that nobody else is on the roundabout, and then you can go on the roundabout and stuff? Well, it's kind of like that because... Well, you don't check whether anybody's on the roundabout, but basically it's a sort of a traffic control point, and there will be latency introduced between the switches.
Would there be any signal degradation as a result of having a bunch of switches together as well?
No. See, with a switch, because either the switches are store and forward, cut through, or fragment free, the switch actually reforms the packet and retransmits the packet out of its own port. So in fact, your 100 meter distance limitation for Ethernet restarts at every switch because the switch is responsible for retransmitting the packets. For real, Charlene, you guys don't have roundabouts, turning circles, where you have all the roads come in and you go round it and then exit the turning circle? Okie dokie. Any questions, queries on any of that? Did any of that make any sense to anyone? There's a couple of names for them. Turning circles, roundabouts. There's another name for them. It has the word circle in it. Anyway, when they don't want to put in traffic lights because they're... Rotaries. Okay, well, that's what you call them. Okay. It's when they don't want to put traffic lights in because they're lazy and they just want to, like, prove how many people don't know how to use a rotary / turning circle / roundabout, in my experience. Multi-access topology needs media control method. Yeah, that makes sense. Point-to-point doesn't tend to need a media control method because it's point-to-point. Now, I've got this thing that says point-to-point can be connected using virtual circuit with packets going through. Intermediate devices, but logical topology is still point-to-point. So this can happen if you're looking at things like ADSL, where you've got point-to-point over Ethernet and stuff. That's sort of what I'm referring to there, even though that note is a little bit confuzzling. I'm just curious, and I don't usually do this, but I might make an exception. Does anybody want a link to my exploration notes folder? Okay, alright. Alright, let's go in here. If you don't have Dropbox, you have my condolences, but you can still download things out of this folder regardless. Let's do this thing. Now, I must warn you all that if these notes make no sense to you, that's your own silly fault because they're my notes. And if something is in these notes, is not in these notes and it is in the test, then that's your own silly fault because you should have been reading the notes from the curriculum anyway. So, no. I think that's got that out of the way. Hang on.
I can also get them later, Carrie, if you want to do other stuff.
No, I'm going to. It's not giving me the link to it for some reason. Oh, hang on. No. All right, we'll have to do that some other time. That's not working. Okie dokie. All right, now the other thing... Depending on the type of environment, the amount of error checking differs. If you are shoveling packets over wireless connections or infrared or Bluetooth, you might require more error checking than if you are shoveling packets over twisted pair or Cat5 or Cat6 cable. There is still error checking on Cat5 and Cat6 cable. There is a 32-bit checksum that they do use to ensure packets are valid and that you haven't got a jabbering transceiver or some sort of transceiver error. But generally speaking, the error checking and stuff logic is lower if the medium is more reliable. So the frame header contains information that's specific to the environment, such as frame headers, etc. And you've got some examples of the headers here, so start frame field, source and destination addresses, which is where the frame's going from and where it's going to, priority and quality of service field, which is responsible for setting the priority of the actual packet and whether or not it is going to... how urgent the data is considered. The type field, which is the upper layer that's going to receive the frame, and the logical connection field. I've never actually seen that used. There's a physical link control field, which is probably like your media independent interface stuff on Ethernet, but I really haven't done a lot with that either. Flow control field for starting and stopping traffic over the media, and congestion control field, which I've never seen used myself, but it probably is used in certain protocols of which I'm unaware of. Physical addresses such as MAC addresses are only relevant to the network segment that they are on. MAC addresses do not travel over the internet. MAC addresses do not travel over the internet, and MAC addresses do not generally travel through routers. This is very important. Once you get to routers, the MAC addresses are stripped off and you tend to route the packets using IP. Trailers are used for end-of-frame markers and error detection codes such as CRCs. If you care about how CRCs work, there is actually a CaviCast in the 2007 folder that explains the calculation. It's not required to understand how the calculation works for this course, but essentially it's a binary long division where you divide the message by the polynomial and you store the remainder as the cyclic redundancy check, because the idea of the cyclic redundancy check is that the data should wildly perturb the value of the cyclic redundancy check. Any questions on any of that? Examples of data link protocols: Ethernet, point-to-point protocol, HDLC, high-level data link control protocol, frame relay, asynchronous transfer mode. I think I'm going to stop there because we're about to hit 10 o'clock.
Kerry, is this the same with IPv6 installations as with IPv4?
Which bit?
Well, the bit about needing frames on the local network and not passing through the router into the internet. And I wonder whether this was still the practice that you'd encapsulate the IPv6 packet in a MAC address frame.
You certainly do. Think of how many Ethernet switches would break if that wasn't the case. It's true that IPv6 doesn't use ARP. It uses a thing called neighbor discovery, which is actually a bit smarter than ARP and is responsible for figuring out which nodes are actually adjacent to you and where they are. However, it certainly still does encapsulate things into frames with IPv6.
All right, got it. And neighbor discovery reminds me of that wonderful traveling salesman problem that we all come across at some point. Anyway, have a great day, Kerry, and speak to you next week, if not soon.
No worries. Take it easy.